Welcome to episode 6 and the final episode of season 1 of the Attended Exchange podcast. Today I'm joined by Carl Bignall. Carl is an old friend of mine and he talks about his childhood, how he broke into the property industry, how he's been so super successful in the design, interior and developing world that he now operates within. And it's really good to catch up with him. So yeah, enjoy the podcast. Let's start right at the beginning, mate. What was young Carl like?
Younger Carl like?
Younger.
Younger Carl moved around.
Childhood, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Childhood, yeah. Oh, gosh. We moved around a lot.
Did you?
It was an active time, I suppose, in that regard. Yeah.
Where are you from originally? West home?
Born in Devon.
Okay.
But that was a temporary status in
nice part of the world.
Yeah, Sidmouth actually.
Yeah, lovely.
So I was born Sidmouth Hospital, small little hospital. Yeah. Still going now. But yeah, we bounced around a lot actually. We moved to Newcastle for a period of time upon Newcastle upon Tyne, so up north. Even spoke like a Geordie for a time.
Did you?
Man and so on. A bit like Ant Dec. And then we came to London, Old Kent Road, in and around Peckham. Okay. Aylesbury, Devon, and we just kind of moved through the sort of triangle quite a lot actually.
Right, and was that to do with parents' work?
Yeah, well, it was mostly my mother actually, because she actually married and divorced 3 times.
Okay.
So they sort of triangulated quite perfectly around the country.
Okay.
So we sort of found ourselves doing this.
So was that quite hard, jumping from sort of primary school to secondary school? Because it's quite a hard transition growing up anyway.
Yeah.
So to jump around all those different places, did you find it sort of reinventing yourself as you're going? Or?
Exactly that. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And I suppose it's funny, really, because that has kind of carried through to a degree in my later life.
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
And you sort of find yourself, well, I certainly found myself almost sort of trying to, you know, understand the world through a perspective which didn't have that level of guidance you'd normally expect. My parents were 19 when they had me. Wow. So you found yourself sort of almost taking in the world as you saw it
and trying
to compute what that actually meant.
And now you're a parent. I mean, when you think about being a parent at 19, yeah, I mean, the mind boggles, doesn't it?
It does. Wow. And that's when you start to sort of retrospectively, you know, have a little look and try. And then you do start, you've got a benchmark, haven't you?
Yeah, you have something to measure against. And you and your mum are really close, aren't you?
She's in Bournemouth now. She did move to being quite close to us for a while, but she just likes being by the sea, really. So she's down in Bournemouth, so she's not very far away. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And teenage Carl?
Gosh, probably a guy that thought he knew everything and knew absolutely nothing.
Sounds familiar, mate. I was exactly the same. You think you know all the, you know, the square root of fuck all.
I mean, we were settled in that time, so it was kind of nice, back in sort of Sidmouth, so it was quite nice. I sort of worked in a local pub as a chef, as it were, or sort of second chef, so, you know, I've always enjoyed cooking, so...
Oh, you still enjoy cooking now?
Yeah, I love it.
See, this is what I love about these podcasts, like, you and I have known each other for probably getting on for 27, 28 years,
right. And
I'm learning more about you now,
because
obviously these sort of questions, when you're surrounded by... You know, mates going out for dinner or in the pub, they don't always sit and
that's
sort of
true.
Ask these kind of
you don't get into that. No,
intimate questions.
I love cooking. It's a skill I think I've enjoyed learning. I mean, when you're quite fussy and picky as I am in everything, but particularly
food, you've got to be in the job you do, right?
Yeah, quite. So you sort of learn quite quickly what you do and don't like, and then how to finesse it, really. So,
And how did you transition into the property industry? Were you literally finished school property?
Yeah, so my mum, so I was debating whether to become a chef, actually. The reason I didn't was because it was the most unsociable job you can have.
Yeah.
You know, you're always working when everyone wants to be out partying.
Yeah.
So whilst I enjoyed it, that reluctance really played a part in it.
Yeah.
And to be really amazing at it, it just felt like a long track to that end result, I suppose. Mm. And then my mother, at this point... My education wasn't ideal, so in that regard, I was kind of keen to get out of it, I suppose. And then weighed up, I sort of started at that time. I was doing A levels in economics, and I was just sort of figuring out whether in business and whether I wanted to sort of maintain that or be a chef or what have you. Then this opportunity came up in sales, local in Exmouth.
Okay.
And I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll work for a company. I mean, if you looked at British Gas, I looked at, it wasn't specific. What I wanted was an international company that gave me reach. So it didn't matter what industry that was.
Just to get out and see the world.
Exmouth and see the world. Yeah. How do I move? It wasn't necessarily London. That was obviously a route that felt natural. And given I'd moved around so much, just I guess probably that was sort of, you know, inherent within my personality at this point. So I sort of took a job local in sales. And I was there for, I guess, 3 or 4 years. And then I moved to Southampton because it was an international, it was a national company. And my view was I'll be here for a year and then I'll move to London. And to the very day, I was there a year.
Were you really?
And I met a guy that knew Mark Cullen. He was his best man. He goes, got to go and work. If you want to be in this in the real estate sales industry, this is the place to be.
There's a young company that's really booming.
I quite liked, for me, I wanted to be in the capital markets was more interesting to me.
Okay.
But this was a reasonable track and I thought I'll just kind of get up there. And,
yeah.
And, I mean, I'm 20 at this point, looking 15, like, you know, at best, I guess. You know, so, you know, I'm not tall. I don't look old. So, you know, it was all, and though it's nice now.
I was going to say, now you look 25.
But, you know, quite right. So, but at the time, they were challenges, right? I mean, I was being asked for ID until I was probably, you know, close to 30 in some cases.
Yeah, my dad was the same. And it, I wasn't, obviously, but that was.
Super unhelpful, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, it has its advantages nowadays. But so when I came into London, you know, we're quite lucky. It's, you know, working for a cool, vibrant company. It was quite young and up and coming and all the rest of it, and, you know, bouncing between sort of Notting Hill.
So you joined Foxtons in what year?
Gosh, 97.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so I joined in 98, a year later.
Yeah.
Because I sat in your old desk.
I remember.
So I would pick up the phone and it'd be my mum.
Yeah, my direct line, exactly.
No, it's Jeff.
So I was 21 at that point.
Right.
And I guess I was sort of like, you know, I always felt that probably within 2 or 3 years I'd go, and I think it took
about
I think it's 4 years in the end.
And if you had the time to do it again?
I would, because I think what it provided me a base education that, you know, I know so many people from those years still to this day, you know, I've always, I think most of my friends now I've known over 20 years, you know, in some cases 30.
Yeah. And a lot of them stem from that time at Foxtons,
yeah,
right?
Exactly that. And they've all gone on to be really successful business owners like yourself and people that have just, there was just a moment back then which, you know, we were all working for John Hunt, who, you know, was an amazing entrepreneur and someone that we all looked up to and respected deeply, and just provided that mentorship, and the culture he'd created, it transcended the industry we were in for me. And it just kind of, that's what sort of bound us together. And we were traveling internationally, got given wonderful cars. It's like, this is 22, 23, this is living the dream.
Yeah.
But essentially I sort of wanted to follow that route into sort of more, I guess, sort of, I suppose, broader commercial roles or broader industry, sort of real estate based industry.
So you did 4 years at Foxtons. I was lucky enough to then go and get a job working in the Caribbean, and then I came back, and you were very much in that 3 year period while I'd been away, which was sort of 2006 to 2009, you completely, you know, reinvented yourself as an amazing designer. How did that come about? When did you do like your first project?
Well, when I left London, I actually went to, I was living in Canada for a year, went to Vancouver.
Right.
And then I moved to Sydney and I spent a year working in Christie's Great Estates. And I ran
with Darren?
Darren hadn't joined at that point.
Okay.
So I was sort of their marketing.
That's interesting.
Marketing head for sort of Australasia, which came to sort of Singapore down, and there's one office in Sydney, but they did the whole of the country.
Right.
And Darren came through my sort of, you know, come join and sort of introduced him and so on.
Yeah.
So our crossover was limited because I then left to work in the capital markets, which was the sort of track I was.
Right. You were always on. Yeah.
Exactly
okay.
that. But during that time within that, you're seeing amazing houses, and it's, you know, they really were the best.
Yeah,
phenomenal.
Well, I followed.
States.
I mean, Darren and I were on training together at Foxtons with Giles Suter and Pete Tobin in the Battersea office back in the day. And
brilliant.
So, you know, Darren and I literally go back to day one of both being estate agents together. And now he's pretty much head of Christie's Great Estates, Sydney, right, Australia.
So Ken Jacobs, who ran and owned that business as a sort of a franchisee, which is how Christie's operate.
Yeah,
he's just at a point where he's retiring. He's been doing so gradually. That they've dovetailed quite nicely. But he joined there, gosh, I want to say 2006, 2007. So he's done almost 20 years there.
Right.
And that is now his life, and he will eventually sell that.
Is his wife Australian? Is that how he ended up going?
His mother, she's English, but her mum's Australian.
Right.
Living in Gosford, just north of, an hour and a half north of Sydney. So that gave the opportunity to live there.
Okay.
So he kind of came and joined. I left there, actually, and then went into that capital market for about 2 years, but then came home because a friend of mine was developing in the sort of super prime London markets.
Okay.
And he'd recently sold a house to a high net worth who was like, look, I want to facilitate more investment into you. If you want to broaden your bandwidth, you know, we can look to develop properties together and you can maybe bring in some more resource. So he reached out to me at that point, and, you know, it was either this kind of like corporate career path, which scared the hell out of me because you can see the next 40 years of your life. You know where your next job is, how long it'll take to get there.
Yeah.
And I've never enjoyed that certainty, I guess.
Yeah, me neither.
Probably coming from childhood again.
Yeah.
That need for change is always in me.
Mm.
So I came home, it was really high risk, actually.
Really high risk,
He was high risk as well.
Yeah. But you sort of thrive off that jeopardy.
I suppose so. Yeah.
Excuse me.
There's a comfort in that for me, I think.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. But anyway, and it was so high risk that he did literally leave a year later because he'd made his money. Okay. But I was designing the two or three things he was under. Well, there was one under development and two that hadn't finished. So I marketed them out and helped move them on, divest them. This is during the credit crunch period, don't forget. It's 2008.
Okay.
But I designed a couple of places with him, and we were having people come to our apartments and houses and saying, look, this isn't the right location or size for me, but I like what you've done. I'll go ahead and find somewhere that I do want to live, and then you can come and design them on for us. And that was basically how it started. And that took some traction, actually.
Right.
But he left within about a year. So I came back, and after he'd left for Monaco, because we'd sold the places, we're living in all the respective places we're developing, which is the world's biggest pain in the ass. I mean, I'm as tidy as any man I've ever met. But when you have to exit every shower and clean it down as though it's not been used, because it has to be a show home the whole time, it got a little bit tiresome. But anyway, he left for Monaco, credit crunch happened, and he sort of insulated himself. And I moved into the house of a friend of mine. And I remember actually sitting in this little sort of third bedroom, which is a tiny little office. And I was on the phone to Nat Malka, actually.
Okay.
She goes, remember this moment. And I was like, I hope I do. In as much as it, you know, it warrants the need to do so.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had my laptop there, and it's like, you know, probably £4,000 or £5,000 at the bank, which Cameron planned to take with him, incidentally. But anyway, that's another story. and that was that, and away we went. And I had a few clients that sort of had a bit of traction with me, and that was it. And then within a few weeks of that, I onboarded my first client, and away we went.
And were you essentially sort of self-taught?
Through working through. I mean, I've always felt design is twofold. You've got to have good taste, and with good taste needs to have an attention to detail. But where it pivots from a development standpoint is understanding the buyer profile. Without that combination, you have nothing.
Mm.
You just have luck on your side, which you can create.
Which probably stems back to your sales training, right? Because
potentially,
ultimately
understanding that, understanding
what
and the likes
needs.
Of. Yeah, and looking at other developers. We were working with those back in those days, you're talking about Candy and Mike Spink, and they had an intrinsic understanding as to the type of buyer they were selling to, what made them different in the market.
Yeah.
So being very aware of that made a big difference
from
that perspective. But yeah, I guess I've always hung on to those principles, really, and developed them accordingly.
And how have you witnessed the industry sort of change in the last... Well, in your period, maybe the last decade or two.
Oh, colossal. More so since COVID.
Okay.
So my industry primarily has been hit by a doubling costs, tripling in some cases. But if you double every single supply and trade that we were used to dealing with, even 2020, that would give you a pretty clear metric as to where things are. I mean, Tregunta Road is an example, that house I finished.
Yeah, it shows that's phenomenal.
2016, 17, I think I finished that.
Yeah.
Maybe a year later. That exact house today would be exactly double to deliver.
Wow.
So that rate per square foot, to give you some quantums, was around £850 a foot.
Okay.
That same set of deliverables now will be around £1,600 a foot.
Wow.
Almost exactly. But what's interesting about understanding that is that the real estate value is exactly as it was.
Yeah.
So that house sold for just under 50 million.
Yeah.
And I believe it would be, I think they're actually looking to sell it for a similar amount now. So that gives you a sense on the sort of,
yeah,
the lack of correlation, which makes the industry that I've come from very difficult to work with, because I would still be buying at a similar level as an unrefurbished
option. But also, you'll know better than I would with regards to the profile of clients, because at that level, I mean, at the granular level of cost, I mean, a bag of sand's doubled in price, right? And that's gone all the way up to, you know, the really luxury items, as you just explained. So sort of everything's doubled in price. So from, I mean, £1,700 a square foot, that is, which, but it makes sense because the quality of the product is unbelievable. But then the clientele at that level, they're not going to want a second-hand home, are they, really? They're going to want everything a brand new product, essentially.
Once you hit 5 years, depending on how well it's been maintained.
It's that short, is it? 5 years?
Five to seven.
That level. Yeah.
Yeah, five to seven, I think.
Because fashion's moved so quickly, don't they?
Fashion isn't so much the issue, because you can create more timeless, you know, timeless environments.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's not unachievable. You know, particularly if you know, whether it be contemporary or you're more art deco and so on. I mean, there are design languages that you can employ that will just maintain
the test of time. Yeah.
But what you won't, you know, buildings are a living, breathing organism. They are going to expand and contract, and they will split, and materiality will warp. And to that end, you know, you will start to feel as though it's tired.
Right.
You know, you'll have, if things aren't used, they'll start to fail. You know, if you've got kinetic elements or mechanical motorized elements, they will start to fail.
Yeah.
And there's that you'll feel it and you'll experience it.
Where do you see the sort of super prime market heading in the next decade? How do you see it evolving from where we are now?
Depends on the perspective. If we're talking about the commercial side of things, so the development side of things, that needs to change at the sales side first, because the cost to deliver these things now, I mean, the most expensive apartment I'm aware of, rate per square foot in London, is being developed at £3,700 a foot.
Okay.
So that is a yacht finish
inside
a house.
Yeah.
And a yacht finish to compare to, you know, the difference between sort of nice quality and the best available is that every surface is clad. So you have a flawless finish and flawless ability to access whatever's behind, whether it be services or a connection to sort of any form of FCU maintenance, those sorts of things, pipework, electrics, you name it, whatever it is. So you would clad off this, usually with some kind of timber profile, and then you'd finish it. And you can control the environment when you bring the environment in. So you're not working with the physical form that's been there for however many years.
Mm.
You're now working with a controlled environment that you yourself have basically designed and framed accordingly.
Yeah.
And you do that right through to your ceilings.
Right.
Exactly as you would with a yacht. So that'll take you to close to 4,000 a foot.
My wife and I were invited to the Wow House down in Chelsea Design area over the summertime. And it was interesting how the ceiling finishes seem to be such a, you know, a thing now in comparison to where they were only 5 years ago. Like every single room in the warehouse obviously has the wow factor to it. But the detail, you know, that's normally reserved to the walls and the floors is now very much on the ceilings as well.
It's
world's
your oyster, really.
So £4,000 a square foot. So I guess, I mean, I used to work at One Hyde Park selling the apartments down there for a period when I moved back from the Caribbean. You know, and they were achieving sort of £6,000 a square foot. So are you aware of anything in your sector now that's sold for £9,000-£10,000 a square foot? Is that really super prime?
Yeah.
What's the highest that you're aware of?
I think both Clarges and the Peninsula Penthouses achieved a £10,000 a foot.
Do they really? Mm. Yeah. Wow. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Okay. Brilliant. In your professional career, Carl, what has been your greatest success to date?
Probably the second apartment I did.
Okay.
When I started working in investment backed developments, the second apartment I did was next door to the Candy and Candy buildings, actually in Rutland Gardens.
Okay, yeah, no.
And we did a triplex there, which had all sorts of complexities and challenges with it, which really harmed its potential in lots of ways. So the risk profile was manageable, but the perception was that it was so high, you had to build that into the price.
Right.
So we I won't talk in numbers, but we picked that up at a very commercial level. And after the refurb, I think we closed that out at close to 46% uplift. And we did so in about 18 months.
With all sorts of hurdles to overcome.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the commercial aspects aside, because that's never what drives the ambition for these things. That just has to make sense to warrant the ambition and the investment. But ultimately, that was an extraordinary home. And it was there to compete with the best in London at that time.
And did you learn a lot doing that one? I guess every project you learn from, right? You're constantly growing as a professional designer.
Not so much on that one. And that's because we didn't have as many difficult challenges. We had complexities. For me, for anybody, you'll only ever learn when you fail. Right? That's the time you really gain the most. Yeah. So successful projects don't advance you forward. I suppose what I learned at that point, more than anything else, was that we achieved nearly 4,500 a foot for that apartment, which would have been one of the top three or four that year. And I suppose what we learned at that point was that if you do just make sure that absolutely every detail is attended to and it is the best version of itself it can be, the buyer will pay the premium that you perceive it to be worth. So I would say I learned that more than anything else on that particular project.
A valuable lesson. Who do you perceive to be your biggest competitor and what do you admire most about their work?
In recent years, the work, the industry I'm in now, we're market making. And as much as we have a model that is utilised in America quite commonly, which is client representation, sort of project lead for world-class projects ultimately. And there aren't, that market doesn't yet exist. It's emerging. So at the moment we will be...
We're normally a few years behind the US, aren't we, over here in the UK, well, generally speaking?
In some things, yeah. I think there's elements that, engineering, we're absolutely exceptional in this country. It's probably the world's leading experts, I would say, in certain areas in that regard. But yeah, it's a bigger country, more people, I suppose. Yeah. They get there a bit quicker in other industries. So why that industry...
Yeah, I'm thinking more about sales.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well... So I guess from a design standpoint, I don't know that I was ever at a level that I would argue I'm a competitor of theirs. I could certainly call out some amazing people that at the time dominated those markets. So that's probably a harder one for me to answer in lots of ways.
Best piece of advice you've ever received?
Know what you don't know. You can be taught everything else.
Very good. And advice that you would give to somebody that wanted to start out in your industry, in your side of things, where would you advise them to sort of go initially if they're still at school and they're thinking about where you want to get into a design-led career?
I think the way that industry is going, if you can't model three-dimensionally, you'll be a dinosaur very quickly.
Right, okay.
So if I was sitting with anybody now and they were asking what approach they would want best to take, it would be get yourself into a world where you can learn and understand all of the available technologies. Rhino is probably the leader in that regard for three-dimensional composition of any design intent.
Go and set yourself on a Rhino course.
I would.
Okay, brilliant. We're just going to take a quick break and we'll be back for part two very shortly. Okay, welcome back to part two. Favourite architect, Carl?
Oh, that's easy. Olsen Kundig.
Okay, and why?
Their humility, firstly, knows no bounds. I'm lucky enough to have met a few times Tom Kundig, and I've worked with them for a while now. They are extraordinary people. So I'd start there.
Okay.
I've also been lucky enough to have been over to see some projects. I was there a couple of years ago, but quite profoundly, I was actually in a place called the Okanagan in Canada, in British Columbia, and I saw he designed and built two vineyards on either side of the valley, but one was from 1979 and one had been finished in, I think it was 2015-16. So to see the kind of the consistency over the 40 years, the underpinned sort of language, and one was a gravity-fed vineyard, one was a more traditional approach to processing and so on. So they actually had components they had to design in to allow for that. And the way the sort of angulation of the actual architecture was profiled in the gravity fed one all had to deal with that and manage that. So that was quite an interesting case study to see them.
Yeah, amazing, yeah.
They are raw industrialist architects.
We'll put a link to their site in the show notes.
They're extraordinary.
Okay. Have you, as you know, the pod's called the Attended Exchange. Have you participated in any or many attended exchanges?
Yeah, I have actually. I think three, from what I can recall, might have been more.
Back with your estate agency hat on?
No. When we started developing, actually, when I came home and I was working, so 2008, 2009, it was quite an aggressive market back then. I remember being, it's quite an intense time because you're literally sitting in an office attending the exchange, and then documents are being biked all over the place. You're running by hand methods in some cases, so that can be quite that's an active traditional process, but all in the same day.
Exciting if you win.
Exactly that, and other more kind of the better way of doing it, as you'll know, is just to sort of get everything done, don't receive a contract, so there's no notification to the other side, you're operating in that way, and then get everything you need in a row, bring the contract in and exchange it, and then you can be a lot more effective.
What's been your best investment?
My best personal investment was probably the second house we ever bought, actually, in Notting Hill. It was a modern flat, which modern buildings generally in London, more different these days, but certainly back then, if it's not a traditional Victorian home, your buyer profile limits to about 5 to 20%. The good thing about that apartment was that if you wanted an apartment with parking and lifts and so on, then that neutralised the rest of the market. So we bought that very well and sold it very, very well as a result of that nuance.
And are you still operating in Notting Hill?
Yes, I have an apartment there at the moment, but because the market hasn't been overly favourable in the last 2 or 3 years, so the work I do now is so consuming, I have zero time for any.
We touched on it before we started recording. Tell us more about what it is that you're doing now, as much as you can.
Yeah, so I can't get into any detail, but in terms of who I work with and to what end, but the business is essentially a client representation business which focuses on world-class homes, which allows us to form and populate the project teams. So they triangulate through to a project lead dynamic from our office, and then we lead as a client interface from that point through to fruition.
Okay, where are you based?
In Old Street.
Okay, great. And business is going well?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I work exclusively for one particular group, and that will remain the case for a few years to come.
The foreseeable.
I would have thought so.
Okay. And if anybody wants to see any of your past work, you've got some beautiful films on your website, haven't you?
I mean, it's becoming quite historic now. Not legendary, as in, it's quite old. because nothing I do anymore can be shared.
Right.
I'm on Instagram, but I rarely participate in any kind of, I don't have any kind of social media outlet, so to speak. So, I'm on there, but that'll give you a sense of what I've done over the last 10 years.
Yeah, before. The Tregunta project that you referred to earlier on, I mean, you've actually got a sort of speed snapshot of the whole building.
Time-lapse, yeah.
Thank you, time-lapse, that's what I'm looking for. If someone sits and watches that for 2 minutes over time, so you can see, I mean, the level of detail in the construction project at that size and scale was just mind-blowing. How long did that take, that project?
That was 4 years. Okay. It's unusual in central London to have a plot of land like that. The house had fallen down under the previous ownership. So we excavated to 15 metres, I think, our dig. There's a very cool, the start of that video actually starts at the top of the camera, so you at the top of the crane, so you've got a 32-metre drop.
That's right.
So that's quite interesting to see it kind of, the sort of piling formed around the external perimeter of the actual the dig, which is over 4,500 square foot of
that
sub-basement.
Did that project consume you for 4 years? Were you working wholly and solely on that for 4 years?
Not just on that one, no. Okay. So at that time I had three other projects on the go. We had an apartment, a penthouse in Down Square. We'd just been finishing the Rutland Gardens, one I'd mentioned earlier. And I'd started a project in the Bahamas.
Okay, quite 4 years.
It's quite 4 years. I was in Nassau every 6 weeks for about 4 or 5 years.
Okay. How was that? Did you get to enjoy any time there, or was it just literally work?
No, I got to enjoy. It was probably a good balance between one and the other. Okay. And the nice thing about being in Nassau is it's a short ride over to the Exumas, which is one of the most beautiful places anyone can ever visit.
That stretch, yeah.
The national park there is beautiful.
We all have numerous obstacles and challenges in life. What has been your biggest hurdle to date, and how are you proud to have overcome it?
Gosh. Feels as though they visit me every 5 years. I guess probably, yeah, that if I go back to my childhood and the disjointed sort of educational experiences, I guess I had never allowed that kind of like just, you know, whether it would have changed things for the better, I don't know. So I don't necessarily see it as a negative. On the contrary, you know, I've been blessed in my life, very blessed. So I see everything that's happened to this point as a very rewarding. Absolutely,
yeah.
You know. So on that basis, I think if I look at that and I think, well, you know, I was born in a small hospital in Sidmouth, Devon, and I'm now lucky enough to live in to live and work in the middle of one of the best cities in the world, and I've lived in amazing cities in the world as well, and I have seen a lot of the world. I think that track doesn't feel as though it was a natural progression. So I guess if I just look at it optically, that's what I would say from that to that in some respects.
You must have pushed yourself out of your comfort zone on so many occasions. I have. I mean, I'm similar to you. I'm from a small market town, Melton Mowbray in Leicestershire. So to move down to the Big Smoke when I was 21, 22, that in itself, I mean, I was quite lucky. So I've got an older sister. So she sort of, I was in her wake because she'd already moved down here 2.5 years before me. She went off to university, which kind of opened my eyes to the thought of going to university. So I went to university for a couple of years in Birmingham and then came down to London. But I constantly pushed myself and definitely suffered from having an imposter syndrome. But I don't see that as a bad thing, because I think if I didn't feel that, then I'd be too comfortable. And I don't think you ever really grow when you're too comfortable.
I don't think for people like that, it probably doesn't leave you. I think the contentment that some crave and need and enjoy, if that's not with you already, it's unlikely to ever be with you.
That's what my wife always says. She's like, why do you have to keep just going after the next project and the next this and the next that?
Yeah, I think there's a comfort in that.
There is. I really like jeopardy. I don't like being comfortable.
Comfort in discomfort.
Exactly. Good phrase. Yeah. Right, a few fun questions to finish off with. If you could relive the 1980s, 1990s, or the noughties, which decade would you choose and why?
That's the easiest question anyone would ever ask me in life, I think.
Go on.
Which would you say?
I'm going to say 90s.
Really?
Yeah. For me, it was really good fun.
Interesting.
Just because it was like fab clubbing. If you talk to the younger generation now, obviously we're getting old. I had my 48th birthday last week. And I chat to people that are in their 20s. Thank you. Chat to people in their 20s. So you were like literally clubbing in the 90s. A bit like how we refer to people sort of, you know, the old generation. So you were around in the 60s. Because if you look back at sort of, you know, when you think about there's a lot in Ibiza in the 90s.
That's true.
No
phones. Yep.
With some
pretty, and even the and the,
with
well,
some
that,
pretty phenomenal
that,
class A's.
That scenario, actually, that the sort of clubbing world in London, which is not, it doesn't exist now. You know, you look at sort of, you know, the Cross and Bagley's and Passion and all the, you know, Hanover Grand. I mean, it was all amazing. But still, for me, I think, you know, this goes back. I mean, I think for me, it's unquestionably the 80s.
Okay.
There is a guy that just likes being by a log fire in a kind of very kind of like nice, dark, moody room watching cool, like, not cool, sorry, the opposite of cool. You know, films from the 80s, music from the 80s.
Yeah, no, okay.
There is something that I...
So what, when you say not
there's
cool
a romance.
Movies, like what? Back to the Future, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, God, the list would go on. Yeah. I mean, you know, Ghostbusters, Back to the Future... I mean, my God, you know, the National Lampoon Christmas Vacation. I always start Christmas off with that movie. Absolutely classic. I mean, there are literally, you know, Top Gun, Cocktail. I mean, there's just hundreds.
Yes.
And the music, same goes, you know.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I think the time before the digital age that emerged in the sort of, in the late 90s and then just exploded in the noughties. I think there's a...
It's crazy to think that we're the last generation that know what life would be like without a mobile phone.
Analog to digital, we lived through that transition. Yeah. So Yeah, I actually, I don't know what it is. There's something about
just nice that period about the 80s. Yeah.
That I just love.
Yeah, okay. Favourite nightclub from back in the day?
Probably Hanover Grand.
Okay, right. And favourite part of London town today?
Notting Hill.
Thought you might say that. And then just finally, you've got two beautiful children.
I do.
Yeah, how old are they? What are their sort of personality traits?
4 and 7.
4 and 7.
Right. I was thinking this the other day, actually. I've got a daughter that has all of my worst traits. And a son that has all of my best traits.
Okay.
And they are the between them, they're kind of like, you know, if I could just match that one, you know, create that, then I'd actually have, you know, something quite compelling there.
4 and 7, that's, I mean, that amazing age. My daughter's just turned 11. So,
wow. So, has she really?
But 4 and 7, that's full on, isn't it?
It is full on. So yeah. They're nearly 5 and 8. They turn in February and March.
How do you manage to juggle the job that you do, which is pretty, you know, all encompassing, time consuming, and being a present dad?
Well, it's probably slightly more exacerbated because I'm a present single dad.
Okay. Yeah, I co-parent.
Yeah. So it's but we, like you, we have a, you know, really nice dynamic, and it's all, you know, the children led, isn't it? So, I suppose in some respects that helps and makes it more challenging.
Yeah.
So it's just another layer of things that you know that has to be folded in, and ultimately they sit at the top of that priority list. Really.
Yeah. I think when you have kids, no one ever thinks, you know, well, some people do, but they don't set out initially normally to co-parent. But I do find that it can work because that structure, for, you know, I'm, you know,
takes a lot
with my dad, with my daughter, she's with her dad, you know, on these nights of the week. So I know that, I like the structure.
Yeah, I think it's you can find a way to make it a better situation. It's not ideal, you know, none of us start life to come into a point where you don't have the kind of perfect white picket fence kind of dynamic of a house, given the sort of, you know, romance I enjoy of the sort of 80s period. You have this, you know, you kind of grow towards a certain point in life as a family dynamic, and that's your aspiration.
Yeah.
So it felt and feels a colossal failure from my perspective, just because I'm, you know, I don't like that notion of failure in any capacity, and that felt for me as a large one. So what that's done is it's driven much harder energy in me to make sure that this is the successful version of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to that end, you know, we have a great dynamic. I live within 5-10 minutes.
Right.
You know, I've got a lovely, you know, lovely barn that sits in this little valley not far from them, full of log fires. I've kind of created that 80s ambiance.
Yeah, great.
With an awesome Kundig aesthetic. So I feel like I've hit a nice moment there.
Yeah,
and they love coming. And it's just, you know.
Yeah, yeah. They've got the best of both worlds.
They do. They do. Exactly that. So, you know, we invest in giving that on both sides, actually.
Yeah. Great. Mate, thanks for being so candid and thanks for your time. I know you're super busy. I know that obviously with the job that you do, discretion is key. But whereabouts can people find you if they want to sort of find you on socials or, you know, websites and what have you?
They probably can't really, in reality. They can't.
Yeah. Okay. But your website, if people want to look at some of your historic projects.
Yeah, my website is myname.com. It's not a hard one to find. So that may change at some point in the not too distant future, just so it better reflects what I do, because turning up to meetings in my current form when they're like, we've just been looking, you know, what are you, a designer, developer? Like, you know, so it's difficult to take from my website what we do now as an entity.
Yeah.
So we're going to tighten that up just for the sake of
so that's potentially an offer, like a rebranding is potentially happening in this year, 2025.
Yeah, it's not a vanity project, as it were. It's more of a professional response to the job I do now. So when we are onboarding consultants and project team appointments, they come into it with a clear understanding as to what we're doing in relation to the sort of client need and project need.
Can we just finish on? We've both got a very mutual friend called Grant Bulstrode.
We do. Who called me at 4 o'clock in the morning, as I mentioned when I got here. Thanks, Grant.
On his stag do, we went go-karting. And I thought earlier on, when I said to you, you know, what were you going to do? When did you go into design? How did you get into property? I thought you were going to say initially I was going to be a Formula One driver. Because you rocked up to Bullbag's stag do with literally all the gear. Yeah, I think you even had your initials on your own helmet. You got boots on. got the possible. Full, got the full suit.
It's possible. I mean, there is context to that, I should say, in as much as my...
And we were like, we are in trouble. We have got literally...
It was good. It was a good day. It was turquoise as well, if I remember rightly, which really added something.
Yeah, you moved all the team with the boots on. It was phenomenal.
I mean, ultimately, we were always going to be wearing...
You came last. We vanished. You got disqualified.
I did.
You were going too quick.
Quite. I had it mainly because, well, two reasons. First of all, and I'm going to provide excuses here, I think, but ultimately, because there is none. But, you know, my friend was karting. I forget the karts he was using at the time. So we both had these things. And he's more of a ridiculous human being than I am, if you can possibly picture that guy. And that's why I had it. And God's like, you know, you might want to bring this. Yeah, he may not have said that, actually. I might have just made that up just to make it feel even more... Be more sympathetic to my my plight, but yeah, that was a good day.
That was a great day.
That was a great day.
I just remember Bulstrode stood there behind some gate with the mother of all afros on. Just, oh, you're there for the evening. Happy stag.
Gosh, I forgot about that. Yeah, that was a long time ago now.
We miss him though. He's moved to Australia.
I miss him greatly, actually. Yeah. I miss him being in Australia.
Yeah,
deeply.
You got any plans to go and see him?
I keep me every at the end of each year. I plan to go the following year.
Right.
But it's just finding that time is really, really difficult. So I'd love to go next year and just spend a bit of time with him. But equally, I was with him last year. We went to the Rugby World Cup in in France. So we were in Marseille.
I managed to catch up. When it came great over time. A year or two ago, me, you, Grant and Amir managed to go for lunch.
Yeah.
We were very kindly invited to Soho House in the BBC building. So that's nice to my story. But yeah, if you're listening, Grant, much love and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Carl, thank you.
Thanks for having
me. Good to catch up.
Yeah, for sure. Likewise. Thanks, Jeff.